You know, it's really interesting when you think about it. The U.S. has been putting a lot of pressure on China, right, with all these tariffs and trade wars, and yet China's economy seems to be doing okay.
It does seem like they're weathering the storm pretty well.
Yeah, so how are they managing to stay so resilient? That's what we're going to be looking at today.
Right. And we've got some really interesting insights from a top expert on China's economy and finance. He's been closely following the recent two sessions in China, which is their big annual political gathering, also known as Liangui.
Liang Wei, right? So kind of like their version of the State of the Union, where they lay out their economic plans for the year.
Exactly. And we're going to break down all the key takeaways from this expert's analysis, giving you a clear picture of what's happening without getting bogged down in all the details.
Sounds good, a shortcut to understanding a complex situation.
Absolutely. And we'll be highlighting some surprising facts and figures along the way.
Okay, so let's dive right in, starting with these post-Liang Wei policy shifts. What's the big takeaway this year? I understand they're really focused on boosting spending by consumers.
Yeah, that's the main theme, boosting consumption. They're doing things like introducing subsidies and tax breaks, specifically targeted at encouraging people to spend more on everyday things like dining out and entertainment.
Makes sense. People are more likely to spend if it's a little cheaper.
Exactly. And they're also bringing back incentives for buying durable goods, which we've seen before with cars and appliances. But this time they're expanding it to include things like laptops and smartphones.
Now, that smartphone thing is really interesting. You mentioned there could be a big surge in demand because people have been holding back on upgrading their phones during and after the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a crucial point. Their expert highlighted that for about 4 years, people in China and actually globally have been delaying phone upgrades.
Right. I mean, it was a crazy time, and a new phone wasn't exactly top of mind for most people.
Absolutely. So now there's this huge backlog of potential replacements. And when you consider China has something like 1.75 billion mobile subscribers,
It's a massive market.
it is. And even if a small percentage of those people decide to upgrade, now we're talking about hundreds of millions of new smartphone sales.
Wow, that's a staggering number.
It really is, and it has ripple effects. Think about the demand for things like DRAM chips, which are essential for smartphones.
DRAM chips. Now, I'm not a tech expert. Can you explain what those are and why they matter in this context?
Sure. So DRAM stands for Dynamic Random Access Memory. It's basically a type of memory chip that helps your smartphone run smoothly.
Okay, so more smartphones mean a higher demand for DRAM.
Exactly. And if the demand goes up, the prices are likely to follow.
So, a policy in China aimed at encouraging spending could actually impact the global tech supply chain.
That's the interconnectedness of the global economy for you.
It's fascinating. Okay, so China's trying to get their people spending, but let's zoom out a bit. We started by asking how China seems to be holding up so well, despite the pressure from the U.S., especially with those tariffs. What are the main reasons for their resilience?
Well, this expert outlines three key reasons. The first is what he calls a vaccination from previous trade wars. You see, China really felt the impact of those initial 25% tariffs imposed by the Trump administration.
They learned the hard way.
They did, but they adapted. They learned from that experience and adjusted their industries and trade relationships to minimize the impact of future tariffs.
So they were prepared for round two.
Exactly. And the second reason is that China is much less reliant on the U.S. market for its exports than it used to be.
Really, by how much?
Well, right now, only about 15% of China's exports go to the U.S.
That's pretty low.
It is. It's a big shift from where things were before. They've been deliberately diversifying their export markets.
Smart move, spreading the risk.
Exactly. And this expert actually calculated that even if the U.S. stopped importing from China altogether, the impact on China's GDP would be around 2.6%.
2.6%, that doesn't sound too bad.
It's manageable. And here's the kicker. Domestic consumption within China now makes up about 60% of their GDP.
So they could potentially make up for the loss of U.S. exports by just increasing their domestic spending a little bit.
Exactly. Even a modest increase of 5% in domestic spending would completely offset the impact of losing all exports to the U.S.
That's incredible. So less reliance on the U.S. means less vulnerability.
Absolutely. Now, the third reason this expert points out is really interesting. He uses the term hostages.
Hostages. Now, that's a strong word.
Yeah.
What exactly does he mean by that?
He's talking about how China has a lot of leverage because it's so deeply integrated with some major players in the U.S. economy, making it very risky for the U.S. to impose really drastic tariffs like that rumored 60% level.
Okay, so who are these hostages that China's holding?
Well, the first one is Tesla, you know, Elon Musk and his close ties with previous U.S. administrations. Well, a whopping 40% of Tesla's global production capacity is in Shanghai, specifically in the Lingang area.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that much.
It's huge. That single factory is the largest Tesla factory in the world, capable of producing almost 1 million vehicles per year.
So if there were serious trade tensions and that factory had to shut down for even 6 months,
it would be a disaster for Tesla and for Elon Musk's image.
Yeah, their stock would plummet.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So Tesla's one hostage. The second one is Apple.
Apple. But aren't they trying to move their production out of China?
They are talking about it. But the reality is that 95% of iPhones, iPads, all those iProducts are still made in China.
95%. Wow. So they're still heavily reliant on China.
They are. And if that production stopped for 6 months, it would be a massive blow to Apple and to the U.S. economy as a whole.
Because Apple is such a huge part of the U.S. stock market.
Exactly. And so many American households have their savings tied up in the stock market. So a major disruption to Apple would have ripple effects throughout the entire U.S. economy.
So Tesla and Apple are two big hostages. What's the third one?
Walmart. Think about it. 60% of the products sold at Walmart are made in China.
That's a lot of stuff.
It is. And imagine if China decided to retaliate against high U.S. tariffs by just cutting off supplies to Walmart.
Empty shelves across America.
Exactly. And that would lead to a lot of unhappy consumers who would likely blame the U.S. government for those shortages.
So it's a delicate balance of power.
Yeah.
These hostages make it very difficult for the U.S. to take really aggressive action against China.
Precisely. Okay, so we've talked about China's resilience to U.S. pressure. Let's shift gears a bit and talk about their long-term financial stability. We hear a lot of conflicting opinions about this. What does this expert say?
Yeah, is China headed for an economic crisis, or are they actually in a strong position?
Well, this expert argues that China is actually in a very healthy financial position, and he attributes this largely to the fact that the Chinese government has a lot of control over the economy.
Right, a more centralized system.
Exactly, and this allows them to manage things in a way that's quite different from many Western economies, which are more free market driven.
Can you give us some concrete examples of this?
Sure. So, for example, a lot of people still think of China as a developing nation, but their per capita income is actually around $13,000, which puts them at roughly the same level as South Korea was in the mid-1990s.
That's higher than I would have guessed.
It is. And even more striking is that the top 50 to 100 million people in China actually have a higher average income than people in the U.S.
Really? Wow. Okay. And what about the whole issue of government debt? Isn't that a major concern for China?
Well, it's interesting when you compare it to other countries. Most major economies today have government debt levels that are over 100% of their GDP.
That sounds unsustainable.
It is for many countries, but China's government debt, even when you include local government debt, is still below that 100% mark.
Really? So they're in a better position than the U.S. or Japan, for example.
Yes. The U.S. and Japan both have much higher debt levels, and they're running significant budget deficits, whereas China has more room to maneuver financially. They also have a more top-down political system, which allows them to implement fiscal policies more quickly and with less public resistance than you might see in a more democratic country.
So they have more agility when it comes to managing their finances.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's talk about some of the traditional vulnerabilities that people have pointed to regarding China, specifically their dependence on imported energy and food.
Right. We've all heard about China's energy needs and their reliance on foreign oil.
Well, that part is still true. China still imports about 86% of its oil.
Okay. And what about food? China's been focusing a lot on grain production, but I remember soybeans being a big issue.
Soybeans are still a major import. China imports around 90% of the soybeans they consume.
Wow, that's a huge reliance on imports.
It is, and it's crucial because soybeans are a key ingredient in tofu,
yeah,
which is a staple in the Chinese diet. And they also use a lot of soybeans to feed their massive pig population.
Right, China consumes a lot of pork.
They do. Around 720 million pigs are slaughtered every year in China, and most of them are raised on feed made from soybean meal.
So where are they getting all these soybeans from, if not the U.S.?
They've shifted a lot of their soybean imports to Latin America because of the trade tensions with the U.S.
So they found alternative suppliers, but is that really a secure solution?
It's definitely something to keep an eye on. There are still concerns about the reliability of those supply chains. Now, going back to oil, while the Strait of Malacca is still a key choke point for oil shipments into Asia, China has been working on reducing its reliance on that route by building oil pipelines from Pakistan and Myanmar.
Interesting. So they're diversifying their oil import routes as well.
Exactly. They're trying to reduce their vulnerability to potential blockades.
It's a smart strategy. And you mentioned earlier that the situation in the Middle East is also a factor.
Yes. China is now Saudi Arabia's biggest oil customer.
That gives them a lot of leverage.
It does. And you might remember that Xi Jinping made a very symbolic visit to Saudi Arabia recently. And there were open discussions about settling oil payments in Chinese yuan.
So moving away from the U.S. dollar.
Exactly. A move towards de-dollarization.
It seems like the whole global financial system is in flux.
It's definitely an interesting time. Okay, now let's go back to the initial trade war between the U.S. and China and the phase one agreement that they signed. What happened with that?
Yeah. Did China actually live up to their promises?
Well, the main goal of the phase one deal was for China to reduce its trade surplus with the U.S. They agreed to buy an additional $200 billion worth of American goods over a certain period.
A lot of soybeans and other things.
Exactly. But then COVID hit in 2020 and that threw everything off.
So they didn't meet their targets?
No, they only ended up buying about 57% of what they had committed to.
So there's still a big chunk of money that they owe the U.S.
Yes, there is. And what's interesting is that the Biden administration hasn't really made a big fuss about it. There hasn't been a lot of pressure on China to make good on that unpaid amount.
That seems like a missed opportunity to exert some leverage.
It does. And it kind of highlights the problem with U.S. policy towards China. It's often inconsistent from one administration to the next.
Right. You had Obama, then Trump, who completely changed things. And now Biden is reversing some of Trump's policies.
Exactly. And even now there's talk of rolling back things like the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act, which were actually designed to help the U.S. compete with China in key areas like technology.
So the U.S. isn't presenting a united front?
Unfortunately not. And that makes it difficult to pursue a long-term strategy.
So what's the current U.S. approach to China? We still hear about tariffs and there's a lot of talk about national security.
Well, from what we've seen, the current U.S. strategy seems to be using tariffs as a stick to punish China while using national security concerns as a carrot to try to get allies on board. And this is all happening against the backdrop of the Federal Reserve's actions to manage liquidity in the financial system.
Okay, so tariffs are still in play, but are they really effective?
That's the question. You see, tariffs are usually meant to protect domestic industries.
Right. Make it more expensive to import goods and therefore protect American jobs.
Exactly. But the problem is that a lot of those industries that tariffs were meant to protect have already moved overseas.
So the U.S. is kind of swinging at a ghost.
In a way, and China has a lot of other export markets, so they can often compensate for reduced demand from the U.S.
So tariffs might be more symbolic than anything else.
Perhaps. And then there's the whole national security angle.
Which is particularly relevant now with the war in Ukraine.
Absolutely. It seems like U.S. foreign policy is shifting a bit, maybe being more accommodating towards Russia in some areas while also pushing NATO allies to spend more on defense.
And how has the market reacted to this?
Well, interestingly, U.S. defense stocks have actually gone down while European defense stocks have gone up.
So investors are maybe losing confidence in the U.S. as a reliable security partner?
That's one interpretation, and maybe there's a growing preference for European-made weapons.
It's a shifting landscape for sure. And what about the U.S. dollar? How does that factor into the U.S. strategy, especially with all the talk about sanctions?
Well, the U.S. has traditionally used sanctions as a key foreign policy tool, and those sanctions rely on the dominance of the U.S. dollar.
Right, because most international transactions are done in dollars.
Exactly. But we're starting to see cracks in that system. Russia, for example, has found ways to bypass the SWIFT system and dollar-based transactions by using the Chinese yuan for barter trade with China.
So they're trading oil and gas for Chinese goods without using dollars.
Exactly. And this is why Putin's proposal at the recent BRICS summit to create a common currency is so significant.
A direct challenge to the dollar.
It is. And it helps to explain why some people in the U.S. are talking about imposing 100% tariffs on countries that try to bypass the dollar system.
Wow. So it's a battle for financial supremacy.
It really is. Okay. So bringing it all together, what does this expert believe is the real U.S. strategy towards China beyond all the talk about trade and tariffs?
What's the end game here?
Well, his opinion is that all the focus on trade deficits and tariffs is really just a political show, a way to justify the real goal, which is to use technology to stifle China's growth.
So it's about containing China's technological rise.
Exactly. He uses the word strangling.
Wow, that's pretty strong.
It is, but he believes that's the ultimate aim, to use technological restrictions to extract wealth from China. And the Chinese government understands this. They know that the real threat isn't tariffs, it's technology.
Because technology is the key to future economic dominance.
Exactly. China has a huge trade surplus and massive foreign exchange reserves, all that China money, and it's very attractive to the rest of the world. So maybe the goal is to find ways to tap into that wealth through technological dominance.
That's a pretty sobering thought. Can you give us a concrete example of how this focus on technology is playing out?
Sure. Think about the global competition for GPU chips, which are crucial for data centers and AI development.
Right. Those are in high demand everywhere.
They are. And imagine a scenario where a company like Hynix from South Korea, which produces those high bandwidth memory chips that are essential for advanced GPUs, is prevented from supplying those chips to a company like NVIDIA because of U.S. restrictions.
That would be a major blow to NVIDIA.
It would. And some people are suggesting that South Korea should demand reciprocal access to the finished HBM products in return for continuing to supply the components.
So it's a high-stakes game of technological chess.
It really is. Okay, so to sum up, China's resilience is based on a few things they learned from past trade wars. They've diversified their export markets. They have those strategic hostages we talked about. They're in a strong financial position, and they're taking steps to address their vulnerabilities in energy and food security.
And on the U.S. side, while they're making a lot of noise about trade, the real focus seems to be on using technology to contain China.
Exactly. So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's a final thought for you, our listener, to ponder.
Something to keep you up at night.
Think about how this interconnectedness of the global economy, as we've seen with those hostage examples and the attempts to bypass the dollar system, is going to shape the future of geopolitics. What does this mean for things like global supply chains, the pace of technological innovation, and the future of international finance? It's a complex and rapidly evolving landscape, so we encourage you to keep exploring these issues and thinking about their potential implications.
Absolutely. There's a lot to unpack here, and it's definitely worth paying attention to. Thanks for breaking it all down for us.
You're welcome. It's been a fascinating discussion.